Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this podcast. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. At hundreds of locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
I'd love to see you play sometime.
Ken Jackson, coach for Allen Football Club. We're looking for a good right winger.
Another brilliant performance there tonight, laddie.
He was there tonight, huh?
Tony Curry wants to give you a trial.
Jimmy, it's your trial tomorrow. You want to make it a quiet night?
Good point, T.
Thank you, bye.
Have 7 large wishes, please.
Today on Trouble with the Script, we're talking the 1996 soccer film, When Saturday Comes. I had J.J. Devaney on from ESPN's Caught Offside podcast, and he was the perfect host for a couple reasons. First and foremost, I'd never seen When Saturday Comes. Honestly, before I messaged J.J. about coming on the podcast, I'd never even heard of When Saturday Comes. It stars Sean Bean, a.k.a. Ned Stark, and so I was a first-time watcher of this film. And I'm also not really a soccer savant. I go into detail about that on the podcast, but you know, I understand the general rules, but I'm not really the right person to go in depth on soccer. So I needed an expert, and JJ was just that. Honestly, this was awesome. This was like an episode where I got to be a listener for a lot of it because he really gave me a crash course on, you know, soccer culture as a whole, life in, you know, Northern England, kind of how this entire movie would work. He really took the concept to heart of breaking down, you know, the authenticity of the movie, the realism. We also kind of talk about the lack of big time soccer films as a, you know, in general. When you think about classic sports films, you know, especially in America, soccer films don't really come to mind. There wasn't a whole lot to choose from, which is, you know, another reason why I was kind of, you know, at a loss of what soccer movie to do first. And so JJ kind of breaks down the state of soccer films as a whole. And for that reason, you know, I really enjoyed recording this episode. It was a good one. If you haven't seen When Saturday Comes, honestly, I don't know if it's absolutely essential if you're listening to this podcast. You know, JJ breaks it down pretty good. But, you know, if you do, I would say that it is on the internet for free. I'm not going to throw out a link or anything. I don't want to get in trouble for that, but it's out there. So give it a look. You know, check out When Saturday Comes if you want to follow along with this episode. This will also be kind of a unique episode in the point that there's fewer clips than we usually drop. There's not a whole lot YouTube-wise on this movie kind of broken up into clips, which is it's pretty common for older movies or, you know, movies from the 90s. So not a total surprise that there wasn't a lot to plug in. As always, please remember to subscribe, you know, leave a 5-star rating, really close to hitting 100. I know in terms in the grand podcast scale, that's not a ton, but, you know, hitting triple digits would mean a lot to me. Keep the reviews coming in. I really enjoy, you know, hearing what you guys are thinking about the podcast. And, you know, make sure to follow on social media at TroublePod on Twitter, at TroubleWithTheScriptPod on Instagram. And, you know, follow along. I've been doing some more interactive tweets lately, you know, got some good responses from you guys when I asked who your favorite fictional movie character was, actually fictional sports character in general, because we did get some Pablo Sanchez's, the backyard baseball legend. But yeah, you know, subscribe, rate, review, you know the drill, pass this podcast on to anyone who appreciates authenticity in sports movies, and let's get going with When Saturday Comes. Welcome to Trouble with the Script, the sports movie podcast focusing on what worked, what didn't work, and what could have been done to improve the realism and sports authenticity of your favorite sports movies. I'm your host, Kyle Bandujo. Joining me for today's episode, he's the co-host of ESPN's Caught Offside podcast, JJ Devaney. JJ, how are you doing today?
Hey, man, how are you?
I'm doing great. I'm excited to have you on. I appreciate you coming on the podcast.
No. It's in honor of Sheffield United being promoted to the Premier League. That's why the film popped in my head, and that's why I thought it might be fun to talk about it.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about the film When Saturday Comes. It's about a factory worker who gets scouted, firstly by the well-known non-league side Hallam FC, and then later by Sheffield United, and he must overcome his own self-destructive behavior to fulfill his potential. Sean Bean, more commonly known now as Ned Stark, plays Jimmy, and his character miraculously doesn't die or end up in jail in this movie, unlike most Sean Bean characters. So, JJ, before we get started, we're talking soccer today. I'm far from a soccer savant. So for listeners who might not be familiar, if you could give me some insight on your podcast and role in covering soccer and why I absolutely needed you to cover today's movie.
Well, you absolutely needed me to cover today's movie because when this movie came out, I was 12 and I was absolutely obsessed with soccer. So there was a dearth of soccer movies at the time. So I'm in a good position to talk about the film. Also, my podcast is on ESPN. I co-host it with Andrew Gundling, and it's wildly popular. I think that's the term, wildly popular.
That sounds right.
And we cover the Premier League, cover the Champions League, MLS, basically anything that's interesting that's happening in the football world. We like to talk about it.
Okay, yeah, and before we get started in getting into this movie specifically. What's kind of your opinion on the state of soccer movies? Because when I DM'd you about coming on the podcast, I didn't really have a movie in mind. Sometimes I'll message someone with a specific movie in mind. And I didn't, mostly because when you think about soccer films, at least here in America, there's not really a long list of popular ones or ones that are considered in kind of the upper echelon, like ones that, directly come to mind. Like the first things that came to my mind were stuff like Bend It Like Beckham or even, something like She's the Man. As someone who grew up, you grew up in Ireland, and this movie we're going to talk about, we had talked about before we started recording, was not made for an American audience. What, in your opinion, is kind of the state of soccer movies? Are there not enough? What do you think?
I would go as far as to say there's no really good one. I think maybe in the last couple of years, the last 10 years, The Damned United is a pretty good film about soccer. Now there is a plethora of brilliant soccer documentaries. There's some excellent work like from the Two Escobars. There's that film, the name of which escapes my mind, where the two college soccer players from America go around the world playing soccer. There's a lot of good documentary films, but in terms of like movies that you go see in the movie theater or that you'd watch on Netflix, there's not a lot. So like, for example, Goal is probably one of the most famous ones. It's the story of a Mexican-American who's dreaming of playing soccer. His father's not terribly supportive. He wants him to stick with the landscaping business. And through his talent, he ends up playing for Newcastle United. And it's a kind of a cheesy, fun film about soccer. And that had three. It had a sequel and then it had a third film. So that did quite well. And then there was a slew of films in the 2000s about fan culture, mostly the negative side of fan culture, hooliganism in England and things like that. So one of the films that made a huge impact in America was Green Street Hooligans, that was starring what's his name,
Elijah Wood. I regrettably had a Green Street Hooligans poster, I think, in one of my college dorm rooms, because it was just all about like drunk guys getting in fights about soccer.
Yeah, and I mean, again, that's not very good. I'm trying to think to go back through the years. There's Gary Oldman. Interestingly, Gary Oldman, the the celebrated Hollywood actor. He had a, before he really made it big time, at the end of the 80s, I think 1989, 90, he did a film called The Firm, which again was about hooligan violence. And that was actually, it was decent as far as soccer films go, but there's not many. There really isn't many. Escape to Victory, or Victory as it's known over here, which was pretty decent and starred Michael Caine. That was good. That was fun. But I don't know. It seemed for a long while when I was growing up that there'd never be a good video game about soccer and there'd never be a good film. Now, the video games have come on unbelievably, and there are many brilliant ones.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's been covered. And so we don't have to worry about that. But honestly, is there like, do I have a go-to soccer movie, which I absolutely love and want to watch over and over again? The answer will be no. So it's a long-winded way to get to it. But the state of soccer movies in general isn't very good.
It's surprising and really kind of disappointing. But just because soccer itself lends itself to a big buildup and a climax, just because there's a lot of times in matches there's so little scoring and a goal is celebrated so much, more than, you know, it's celebrated probably more than scoring in any other sport, because it's so built up and sometimes there's such a long time between scores and it can be so dramatic. And you know, you've got penalty kicks, which is about as dramatic a sudden death thing as you can get in sports.
I think though, like the concept, it's not so much the concept of a soccer movie that's bad, that soccer can't be put on the big screen. It's I guess that the stories on the angles and the narratives, once they get to the table of a Hollywood director or someone, it's always somebody who's outside the game. It's always somebody who doesn't really know the game, and what it ends up becoming their vision of what soccer is and not what it actually is. And also, just in terms of in play, like how the game feels like when you watch it, do you believe that this could be a soccer game? And it's almost with every single film, including Goal, it just doesn't look right.
Well, that's exactly, what this podcast is all about, is is celebrating sports movies that look right and, you know, feel super authentic, and then kind of talking about the ones that don't and why that happened. So, let's go into When Saturday Comes. And right off the bat, tell me, is this a Hall of Fame sports movie, an all-star sports movie, a starter or a bench warmer for you?
I think it's a starter because, it's a solid effort in many respects, and in other respects, it falls disappointingly low. I do feel that it was, first of all, the director is an American, and that's not to be disrespectful to the American soccer fan, but it's someone who hasn't grown up with the game, and it feels as if this is an outsider's view of what soccer culture and growing up in the north of England feels like. It's a starter. In fact, I would go as far as to say I'm more likely to rewatch this one than any of the others. So I'll give it, I'm presuming on your grading scale, Kyle, that starter is decent. It's middle of the road.
Yeah, decent. And I'd say the same thing. That's how, and admittedly, I did my first watch of this movie after you picked it. I actually did my first watch of this movie a couple hours ago, so it's pretty fresh. I would say starter. It had, it wasn't, it wasn't terrible. I only started this scale, 2 episodes ago, but of the, the 14 episodes I've done now, or 13 or 14, something like that, I would only give bench warmer to one movie so far. This one was a starter. It's something that, if it was on TV, it's not going to be on American television, but if it was, I would turn it on. It has some rewatchable aspects.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that there are some really good actors in it. Sean Bean is a good actor, and Pete Postlethwaite, who is sadly departed, was a doyen of the British film industry and had some amazing roles in some really good Hollywood films. So, he's a very good actor too. I'm not sure the role that he was given as manager of Hallam FC was perfect for him. I'm not sure they gave him enough good lines. He kind of moved from proud to irked very quickly. Yeah, there was no middle ground, and he wasn't a big guy on second chances and had to be coaxed into a second chance in an almost corny fashion. But, you know, there's Sean Bean at that point in his career. This is 1996. So that's a good, 7-8 years after he filmed The Field with Richard Harris, which was an acclaimed, critically acclaimed movie. So Sean Bean is an actor of some standing at this point. And Pete Postlethwaite is like I said, he's one of the big hitters in British film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, and he made some, you know, he was in some, I think one of his last movies was The Town.
Which is, The Town is kind of, The Town is underrated. I think The Town is...
I love The Town.
Yeah, I think The Town is better than people give it credit for, and it doesn't get talked about an awful lot. But I will, an absolutely compelling character in it is the florist played by Pete Postlethwaite. He is a some kind of an Irish American gangster. His accent is on point, and he seems vicious, and he plays it very well. So this is a guy of look. I know he's done brilliant work, including In the Name of the Father, where he played Giuseppe Conlon, and like that, he was absolutely magnificent in that. So this is a very good actor, but definitely underused in When Saturday Comes.
I was really excited to see him, though, because he was one of the only other actors that I recognized. Real quick, before we get into it, I'm doing the realism scale. I'm calling this from Bush League to Big League. I got that from a listener whose name I don't have in front of me. I will shout you out on next week's episode, I promise. But rank the film's sports action and plot points on a realism scale from 1 to 10, 1 being Bush League, 10 being Big League.
Oh, because you're asking me to combine the sports action and the plot points. I would go as far as, I'll give it a generous 5 right in the middle.
Okay.
Because there are certain elements to the film where you're just like, this is kind of ridiculous. And let me deal with one of them while we're talking about that.
Yeah, go right into it.
So, Sean Bean, look, 37 is not old, right? On your life scale, 37 is not old. It's you're still a young man, and I'm not saying Sean Bean looks particularly old in this, but 37 is too old for a professional footballer, even to make the meteoric rise that he made, this fairy tale rise. Now, it's never suggested to us in the film that Sean Bean is 37, but
he looks
as an actual man in real life, when he did this film, he was 37. And once you become aware of that, you notice certain things about, like, you know, his face. You also, if you've seen like the aforementioned The Field, where he plays a younger man, that's 7 years beforehand, you realize that kind of eats away at you. Now, in soccer terms, have we had stories in the past, you know, decade of players who have taken a circuitous route to top flight football? Yeah, we've had Ricky Lambert, who for a while, he ended up at his hometown Liverpool team in his early 30s, but he had always been a pro along the line. But at one point he was playing semi-professional level, as our character does here in When Saturday Comes, Jimmy Muir, and Ricky Lambert worked part-time in a beet factory, processing beetroot. So, you know, that happens. There's also the tale of Jamie Vardy, who was in the lower leagues and worked his way up. But, I mean, Jamie Vardy, when he finally made it big, or when he really made it big in the Premier League, was still very much solidly in his mid-20s. So when you've got the knowledge that Sean Bean is in real life 37, and also when you see him, even when you see the close-ups of his face, He looks dramatically older than his girlfriend, played by Emily Lloyd.
He looks older than his brother, too. The guy who's supposed to be his brother who passes away in the movie, and they say at age 24. And he looks dramatically older than him, and early in the movie you see them as kids, and they're very close in age.
Right, exactly. And that is jarring then to see it. Now, I am pretty sure that the director... and the producers were not football people, and they did this casting by numbers. So Sean Bean is a massive Sheffield United fan. He knows the region. He knows the city very well. And actually, in 2004, I believe, he was part of a group that came in with money to help save the club when it was in financial difficulty. So I kind of get the feeling that it was almost, you know, casting by numbers. Sean Bean, you know, an athletic-looking dude, Sheffield United, absolute Sheffield United fanatic, let's give him the role. And also, you got to sell the movie as well. So you got to put a star in the lead role. And I think that's how we got to Sean Bean, because I do find it a little bit, he does look mid to late 30s, and that makes it less realistic in terms of his career progression.
I had that as my least realistic thing, too. So despite not knowing much about soccer, I'm glad that stuck out to you as well. That makes me feel good. What was your most authentic? Was there anything in this movie? You mentioned kind of that there have been stories about guys going from semi-pro to... If you could kind of, real quick, unless this is your most authentic, explain kind of Jimmy's rise, because it looks like he's playing for his, like, the pub team, and then he gets picked up. Is pub team, like, is it like men's league softball here? Or how does that work? Is that a realistic how he went?
Pub team is, I suppose for the mid-90s, when this was filmed, 1995, 1996 direction, that although it was becoming less and less, that was still a route. So, for example, Arsenal's record goal scorer prior to Thierry Henry, Ian Wright, he came up through a certain route. So, basically, pub league is men's league. It's Sunday league. So, it's amateur. They call it pub league because, well, a lot of the teams are sponsored by bars, and that is where people go afterwards. A lot of the teams were assembled around... Initially, we're assembled around guys who would drink together in the same bars. A pub league is a kind of a disparaging term, but it's really Sunday league, amateur league. And then the step above that would be the regional leagues, which are, a lot of them are semi-professional. And, you know, that progression is not unrealistic. Like I said, I'm trying to think of guys now who made that progression. Now, that progression was much more common in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s. But as the game became... as money flooded into the Premier League and players came in from abroad and more academy players started flooding into the league, it was less likely that you would make this kind of progression from your local amateur side right the way to the top. But, for example, a player that's still playing for Manchester United, who is a veteran now, Chris Smalling, he was at, I believe, Maidstone United, which was an amateur league team that a friend of mine used to play for. And so he got spotted there, and he ended up at Fulham, and then he ended up at Manchester United. Ian Wright, he was quite a late bloomer. He was playing local league, again, like Sunday league football. He got picked up and ended up at Crystal Palace, and his career blossomed from there. So that was an established path in the past. It's not crazy to think it would have still been a path in 1996. That wasn't unrealistic. That was fairly realistic. Now, what was strange about it was that, again, when I talk about this was a cabal of producers and directors who are not football people, and the director is an American, and I don't really know her background in the game, but you see little things where they're imagining what the north of England is like and what football culture in the north is like. Did you notice, Kyle, how the fields were constantly mud baths?
I have that in my notes. It was a kind of a question. How every game they play, every game they show him playing for them, he is covered in mud. It's like raining and muddy, and it looks like a scene from Braveheart.
So, and we only see him play for Hallam United twice, or Hallam
FC.
I think
there's two matches. He plays, I think he plays for his, we see one or two of his like men's league, his pub team, one or two Hallam, and then you see him riding the bench for Sheffield a couple times, and then the final match. I mean, majority of this film's soccer, I would say 50% of the soccer is in the final match, basically the final scene of the movie.
Well, yeah, and what they seemed to do was they seemed to film at an actual Sheffield United game, and they took the crowd shots and everything, which was pretty good.
Yeah, I like that.
I did like that element too. The only problem was that Pete Postlethwaite and Emily Lloyd appeared to be at a daytime game. So when you saw the dark of the stands, the floodlit of the stands, versus when the camera pan to them, they seem to be backlit almost like it was a day game, which that's a tricky one, and it's one that producers and directors still run into to this very day. Sunderland Till I Die did a lot of football montages for its games, and at one point they took the action from the game that they were referring to, but the sideline shots of the manager from another game. And, you know, the seasoned football fan who knows the difference between grounds, who can tell you the difference between the you know, what a day game and a night game looks like, or even an evening game and an afternoon game, they could pick that out straight away. So that's a problem that still happens. It was something that annoyed me a little bit. I don't know if you noticed it, but like when it panned to Keith, the manager of Hallam, played by Pete Postlethwaite, in the stand for that final game, it was hugely, the lighting difference seemed massive, and that was irritating to me. But back to the fields, if you notice on the goal, here's what was realistic. The goal he scored for Hallam, where he slides it in at the near post in the rain, that was awesome. That looked really good. I think that was his first game for Hallam.
Mm-hmm.
And then in his second game, he scores a goal while the Sheffield United scouts are there. And that was, I'm not saying that didn't look realistic, like the ground and everything looked realistic, but the field was so sodden. It had so much water on it that you see one of the extras slide into the post. He falls on the ground and just he almost surfs along this mud into the post.
It was an obscene amount of mud on the pitch.
It was, and they've clearly gone big on the mud. And again, that's why I say this is the vision of football culture from people who probably never have been to a game. That is far too much. You can still do a realistic Sunday League and semi-pro view of the game without dousing the field in gallons of water.
See, that's one of the things that irks me about sports movies, and that's why I needed someone who knew soccer for this one, because it astounds me over and over again when movies seem like they did not bring on someone with legitimate experience in the sport. Or it astounds me because I feel like that's a small fix. That's you just need one person who's familiar with soccer in Northern England who says, "Hey, this isn't how the field's supposed to be. Let's go somewhere dry," and boom, it's fixed. It's not crazy. It's not a mud pit.
I'd like to think that Danny Boyle, if he had been directing this, would have gone much softer on things like that. It's also there's a phrase from England. It's grim up north, and that's usually said by Southerners. There's an idea of a north-south divide in England, which in many cases, socioeconomically, is true. You'll notice in the film when one of the real moments where it plays to this theme of the north-south divide is where he is sat with Emily Lloyd, with his girlfriend, at dinner, and she says to him, she goes, "Well, I'm going to go to London to go to college. I'm going to go to London," and he goes, "London." You know, like as if, why would you go to London? As if working class people in the north are, you know, they don't have aspirations to go to London either. And then she goes, "I'm going to go to college." College? Oh, there'll be a lot of poses down there, you know, like this idea of London being this strange, quaint place, and the simple people of the north of England don't want to, you know, even countenance going down there. Like, why would you go down there? There's nothing there for you. So in actual fact, it reinforces a lot of the themes of English soap operas like Coronation Street, Emmerdale Farm, where anybody who goes away, they never do well, or they do well and they come back, but it's a chastening experience for them, you know. So there was a kind of there's something of a class struggle going on in this film. The portrayals of working class northern people are so outlandish.
It doesn't portray them in a very good light.
No,
a lot of them.
Well, now this is a good 22 years or 20 years. We'll be generous. Prior to the Me Too movement and prior to kind of a more, how shall I put it, a more fair and balanced look at gender and things like that. So, for example, one of the opening scenes in the brewery, there's a guy looking at page 3 of The Sun, which was always the topless page in The Sun tabloid newspaper. And
the guys are all leering. And I don't know how many times in the opening 20 minutes somebody says, oh, I give her one. You know, it was quite it was quite misogynistic. And it portrayed northern people, people from Yorkshire, as being, you know, massively disrespectful. And then they're in the bar, and Jimmy, who seems like at points quite a sensitive character, you know, he feels he has to say, oh, I've shagged both of them, as the two girls walk by. And there's a lot of, you know, get the round. How many times do they say get the round in? And they drink, I mean, they order up a huge amount of whiskey for people who are supposed to be on these low wages. So there's kind of, there's problematic reinforcing of stereotypes of working class people in this film, which lends me to believe that it was very much a London-driven project. And also as well, we've got to remember, this is 7 years, 6 years after the Taylor Report. So films about football in the 1980s were usually documentaries talking about how bad the hooligan crisis had got, or hooligan films like The Firm, like I mentioned before. But the Premier League had started, and so money had flooded in to English football, and all of a sudden, middle-class and upper-class people were taking an interest in a game that was almost exclusively for the working classes and was looked down upon. So is it any wonder that if you ask people who are of middle-class, upper-class, cinematic background to do a film about northern culture and northern football and the working class game, is it any shock really that they have these entrenched stereotypes of what the male characters would be?
Well, they really wanted to hammer home, they hammered home the point that these guys, that all they want to do is work their manual labor jobs and chase tail and get drunk. And they kind of hammer that home about Jimmy, Sean Bean's character, the whole time. You know, don't turn out like your dad. You know, don't watch the liquor. You know, it's going to get the best of you. And then, you know, real quick, I want to go into he has like the worst week ever, his character. They just like flip it. They turn him into just kind of like the worst version of this stereotype ever. So he finds out his girlfriend is pregnant, which is like not a bad thing, but it's just bad how he reacts. It is bad to him. And then he gets fired. He punches his boss. He gets fired. He goes out. He gets just loaded, and he cheats on his pregnant girlfriend the night after. Then he shows up to his trial with Sheffield, and he blows it because he's massively hungover. Then later that night, he gets caught cheating. She catches him right away. So he screwed there. Then he gets in a fight with his dad, and then his brother dies, and then he last minute aborts a suicide attempt. He had like they're like, okay, let's hammer home what's the worst thing that could happen to this stereotype, could happen to this dude, and they just hammer it home in 1 week.
Yeah, there was no sense of pacing with that. That was all jammed together. I mean, spread the misery out a little bit, and also I don't know I don't know if you felt the same way, but for far too long in that movie, I was like, why is his dad such a prick? You know, why is his dad such an asshole? Because there's not a ton of scenes of him drinking. There's only a couple of scenes. There's quite a few scenes where it alludes to a gambling problem. But I'm trying to find the source of his father's, you know, resentment towards his son. And he comes across as a pathetic character who borrows money off them, but also as this kind of, you know, person who delivers these broadsides to them about the fact that their lives are not going anywhere. And I'm just like, I wonder, would it have been better to introduce that this guy was resentful because his football career had failed earlier in the film rather than later, and then jam all this stuff together? And like, you know, the other side to it is as well, we see him in the pub when Jimmy finally at the denouement of the film, where Jimmy's, or the denouement of Jimmy's story, where Jimmy's playing against Manchester United, and his father is in the bar, and Jimmy scores, and his father just shows no emotion whatsoever.
Yeah, the father character was miserable. It just, the whole movie was just a miserable character and didn't really bring much. They mentioned that he was bitter because of his own football career.
Yeah, but not a lot of times in movies. An hour in.
Yeah, not until an hour in. And a lot of times in movies, that's a reason for the guy to be even like harder on the kids. Like, you got to do this because I did. But yeah, they don't really, they didn't develop the character properly. It was really frustrating.
No, yeah, it was. And
I thought they did too slow a job developing Jimmy as the self-destructive guy too. Because they weren't really that. They kept, like, you kept hearing about it. Hey, you got to watch, you know, you got to watch the drinking because you're, you know, if you're trying to be a soccer player, you know. But you don't see him ever getting in excess, or, and he's pretty respectful to his girlfriend. They don't really show any of these tendencies. And then suddenly in 1 week, he, you know, fights his boss and, you know, turns into like a frat star, you know, in 1 week.
Yeah, yeah. And like the other side to it is as well, Kyle, with this film. Jimmy is this like enthusiastic kid who really wants to play football and be a professional, and he doesn't make England schoolboys, and that's laid out for us early. But what annoys me is the idea that he, the night before his second trial, that he would go out. Now, am I saying that no footballers have ever gone out the night before a game, particularly in that era of the game in England? Of course I'm not. And it's just the idea that this is a working class guy and he couldn't possibly stay in the night before. Like, you know, like this was his dream as a kid and yet he couldn't stay in the night before. It's not, I'm just not buying it. I'm not buying it.
It's the only time you see him go all, they don't lead up to that. It's the only time you see him go all out and get absolutely smashed in the movie. If he would, if they would have built him up as he's really struggling with alcoholism or something. He's really, you know, he guy goes out all the time, but it's like the only time I think you even see him get over the legal limit. And he just goes crazy before the biggest, you know, before the biggest moment of his life. So, you know, they didn't build up his internal, you know, his struggles with his own behavior. They didn't build that up well. You didn't really buy that when it came time to, okay, he's going to get smashed before his, you know, his second, you know, trial with, you know, with Sheffield. Real quick, was there anything else that worked for you? And can Sean Bean play? You watch him, you know, you said he did some good things. The first goal looks good. He's really the only guy that they give a lot of camera time to. A lot of it is just quick cuts and random stuff. And he's the only one who you see really handling a soccer ball much. Does he look like he's done it before? Does he, you know, does he look like he could be a 90s soccer player?
So like I said, there was the first goal that we see him score in the amateur league. By the way, there's no nets. It's as if they have that little pride that they wouldn't put nets on the goals. Like, but honestly, I feel as if there'd be nets on the goals as well. You don't have to downplay the level he was playing at so much. You've already got a goalkeeper who inexplicably lets a goal in because he's combing his hair.
Not paying attention.
Hey, listen, there's bad goalkeepers at that level. There's bad players at that level, but just not paying attention like that was laying it on too thick. So can he play? So at times in isolation, like that goal where he slams it in at the near post for Hallam, that looked fine. But when you isolated him, certainly one of the training drills where Pete Postlethwaite has him on his toes and he's heading it back or he's chesting it and playing it back, he just, like, there's no way. He just looked like a regular dude doing it.
I thought he looked real stiff. I thought I could have done that.
Yeah, he did look stiff. He didn't look like... not. Yeah, there's certain ways that players move when they're good. There's just... you look at them and you can tell straight away that they're at a... they have a basic level. And he didn't look like he had it. The dribbling in and out of the cones... all right, okay. You need a montage. It's a classic. Again, easy to know it was an American director. Have we seen an underdog sports movie that doesn't have a montage? No, we have not. You have to have a montage. And some of the things he was doing in the montage, like there was a lot of running, which made me think that we want this guy running because the football just doesn't look realistic. But in the cones montage, where he's dribbling in the ball, the soccer ball in and out of the cones, the guy who lets that scene down is Pete Postlethwaite, who is way, way, for a hardened, grizzled, old, seen it all before football man, he is way too enthusiastic about, like, you can see him, he's almost skipping forward as if, yes, he can dribble in and out of cones. This boy's got the chance.
You know, like, that's, that was way, way, way over the top. By the way, before we go any further, and before I forget to mention it, I'm not sure what part of England Emily Lloyd is from. I'm going to guess she was maybe classically trained in London. Maybe she went to the Royal Shakespeare Academy. I don't know. But to give her an Irish accent...
I was going to ask about that.
It is fucking awful. I have seen, like, in terms of atrocities towards Irish actors, it's hard to touch Hollywood. It's hard to touch Tom Cruise in Far and Away. It's hard to touch or even get close to the sheer awfulness of Brad Pitt in The Devil's Own. But this is a new low. Emily Lloyd is shocking. That accent is, every time she opens her mouth, I get the chills. I am absolutely, I want to swallow my own head. It's so bad. So, like, what? And she's English. Why would they not just give her a Sheffield or Yorkshire or just a basic English accent and say she's moved in or she's come up from the south? To do that to her was wild. Absolutely wild. And the scene after their first date where she's just saying random Irish words in Gaelic is just awful, awful.
You were right. She took lessons at the Italia Conti School in London per Wikipedia. I'm sure I mispronounced one of those words, but yeah, I didn't, I'm surprised that they made that decision then to give her an Irish accent. Why don't we, let's go into what else didn't work. What else didn't work for you in this movie? What wasn't on the level? What wasn't realistic?
And really what stood out for me was the trial scene. The first trial scene where, you know, he's dribbling with the ball and nobody's getting close to him.
It's like one-on-one. I had this down. I'm so glad that this is what you said. It's like one-on-one and he's just, it's like they just put that one guy on him and they just kind of let him go where no one else comes to get him. I've watched enough soccer to know that that's just not a thing.
No, and he's also moving rather slow and awkwardly. And there, it pans back to the bench twice or to the scouts twice or three times. And you're like, oh my God, is he still on the ball? And it just wasn't realistic. Interestingly, so again, they're trying to be authentic in an inauthentic way. So they give Sean Bean, who is a Sheffield United fan, they give him the lead role. They also get in an actual bona fide, probably Sheffield United's greatest ever player, Tony Curry. So Tony Curry features in the film as some kind of scout or managing director. And Tony Curry is there in the film and plays himself, but hardly has any lines whatsoever. He's quite a mute character in it. And I thought, oh, okay, that's interesting. But if you don't let Tony Curry talk, or don't give him a line where he talks about, oh, playing for Sheffield United, how much that means, you know, something like that. I mean, he's just a dude if you don't do that. And so I felt that didn't work. Again, another nod to trying to be authentic. A bona fide Division One player, a guy who has one cap for England and played for Leeds United and Sheffield Wednesday, the other team in Sheffield, Mel Sterland is in this film. Mel Sterland, who was still a footballer at the time, is in this film. And he is the only other professional footballer of the extras. And his role is bizarre. So when Sean Bean comes on the film, comes on the field in the final game against Manchester United, the big build-up to his glorious moment where he gets to play for Sheffield United, Mel Sterland is on, and Mel Sterland plays the character that goes, you shouldn't be on this field, you're not
okay, good enough. So he's that guy. Okay, I had a question about him.
Why?
Because go ahead. I mean, yeah, what's the point of him doing that? And then he loves him after he scores that goal.
Well, the point being is footballers will barrage and instruct and bark orders at each other in the game. But if a guy's your teammate coming off the bench, he's highly unlikely to tell you after your first tackle where you crunch into a Manchester United player, what he's most likely to say is, calm down, son, you're going to get sent off, relax, relax, you know, get your, you know, kind of get your feel into the game, feel your way into the game, relax. He's not likely to come over and just like destroy his character in front of him. You know, it was just, it was bizarre. And it was such a misuse of an actual pro. I cannot believe they had an actual pro on set who would just go along with that.
And he goes from that, and from I think he took the throw in from him. Ball went out of bounds. Jimmy was going to throw it in, and he's like, you know, he's like a big dick about it, and he's like, I'm throwing this in or whatever. Jimmy scores a goal, and then, you know, 20 minutes later, this guy is his best friend. Like, Jimmy gets knocked to the ground for that penalty, and he's like, oh yeah, you know. You know, he's all about Jimmy, and they have Jimmy take the PK, and it's that whole thing was bizarre.
Yeah, and here's what doesn't work as well, Kyle. They spend so much time reinforcing the misery of Northern life that they crammed in two games. Okay, they gave United its due. They give the United game where it's his, like, his coming out party where he scores the goals and scores the winner from a penalty spot. They gave that its due. But there's two other games against Arsenal, like fucking Arsenal, a huge team, and Leeds United, where he's on the bench. Now, he's miserable on the bench. Will my chance ever come? What are you talking about? You literally turned up drunk to training, to your second trial. You had to beg to get a second chance. Your second chance has come through. You're about to live your dreams. You're on the bench. That's where you're going to be. You know, the idea that he is inordinately upset about his bench appearances. Like, do you think you'll get to play? I doubt it. Well, my response would be, I'm on the bench for Sheffield United in the Premier League. All my dreams have come through. Despite this awful mess I've made of everything, I'm here. You know what I mean?
And less than 7 months, because think about it. So his girlfriend Annie is pregnant, and she's not super pregnant by the end of the movie, and she definitely hasn't had the baby. So less than 9 months ago, he was playing for a team sponsored by a pub, and now he's sitting on the bench for Sheffield United. One thing about that is, do you remember the scene where he's listening to the radio and the radio announcer's like, oh, you know, are they going to use new guy Jimmy or whatever? Like, why the fuck would the radio guy be talking about the guy they just pulled from the pub team? Like, they wouldn't be like, oh, is he going to use this guy? Like, he, you know, why isn't he using this guy?
But the idea that he'd need the radio to know doesn't seem wholly realistic. Now, you'll hear stories about, players who have become kind of frozen out at their clubs, and they're driving down the road and they hear that a fee has been agreed for them on the radio, and they don't even know they're being transferred. Like, shit like that does go down. Like, football can be a cold business. But the idea that he would be announced on the bench and he wouldn't know already, like, why is he listening to the radio? He'd know he's on the bench. The manager would have pinned the team sheet up on the board, and he'd know he's on the bench. And, like, why would he expect to be starting? Like, he's literally been given this golden opportunity come up from non-league football out of nowhere. They needed, for the football fan, for the football nerd like me, what they needed to do was really show him in training for Sheffield United. Show the interaction with Mel Sterling's character. Show me why they don't get on. Show me why, you know, he's so aggressive towards him in the game against Manchester United. Like, I would have loved to have seen, like, an absolutely overjoyed Jimmy in his first training session for Sheffield United. You know, like, show me that.
Show him actually feeling like he's living his dream instead of pissed. Like, it'd be like if I was on a Major League Baseball bench, I'd look like a kid in a candy store. Like, I wouldn't be able to believe that this was real. And Jimmy's just like, ah, man, this fucking blows.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And like, and his girlfriend even saying to him, oh, do you think you'll get playing or whatever? Like, maybe that question might be asked, but he would just be so overjoyed. By the way, he'd be the king of the absolute castle. All his friends are in the bar watching the game. They would be rooting for him because he's one of their own. They would be so pumped to be able to say,
oh my God, that's our Jimmy on field there. You know, like it just.
Yeah, I thought the pub would have been so much rowdier. And then because of all this, his first goal, when he scores that goal, it's really understated in the movie. They didn't even film it in a super dramatic way. There was no big music. There was no even slow-mo. Like, it was really understated. Like, it didn't get me going at all. I was thinking that his first goal would be something. We'll get into what the big chill is here in a minute. But I thought that would be what, like, kind of gets me going. And I was just like, oh, well, look at him. He scored. Like, they didn't make it seem like as big a thing as they should. This life altered, like, scoring a goal in Premier League. Like, you know, a handful of humans who have played soccer ever have done that. And it's crazy.
His hometown team in front of his own fans against the biggest club in England at the time. It would have been, I would have gone nuts. The shirt would have come off. Like you've got to give more than that, you know? It's just, yeah, I feel like they gave, the pacing of it was wrong, and they gave so much emotion to the attempted suicide scene, to the burial of his brother, to all those things in that awful week, that they had nothing left then for actually what the whole film is supposed to be building towards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they could have made the beginning a lot. They could have sped through the beginning and then given us more Sheffield. I guess that's how you kind of improve the movie. I've got one more thing that didn't work, kind of from a sports centric position. Like I haven't played soccer. But I've spent a lot of time in locker rooms. I did play sports. And after, I think, his first game with Hallam, maybe his second game with Hallam, he scores a couple goals, and they're all celebrating the locker room. That is a bunch of naked dudes all touching each other in a very small tub. I've been in some locker rooms. I've never seen that much comfort in touching naked dudes. It was very uncomfortable. So there was like 10 dudes sandwiched in a very tiny tub. I just don't see that happening.
I'd like to tell you that that's not representative, but that scene didn't bother me at all. The big bath is again that was a classic. If you look back at old pictures of the FA Cup final of 1950s, and they used to allow cameramen in the dressing rooms, and they'd take pictures, and you see these enormous baths, and you'd see players in there drinking cans and smoking woodbine cigarettes. Locker rooms are like that. There's horseplay. There's guys jumping around. I've been in enough myself. It's that scene didn't bother me as much.
Yeah, I've seen the shower horseplay and everything. I mean, I've been in locker rooms, but yeah, that seemed like very close quarters to me. But if that was authentic, then, you know, chalk up an authentic point to this movie, then. Good for them.
I was all right with that one. I was pretty okay with that.
So, was there a big chill in this movie for you? A moment that gave you the chills? I mean, you already said the accent gave you the stupid chills. So that might be it. Was there, did anything in this movie really make the hair on the back of your neck stand up?
Yeah, there's a few moments where I feel like that, you know, they're, the alleged working class banter, you know, there was moments like that where I'm like, ah, that's just, I can't, you know, I really like the idea that they just go around in this kind of like heightened state of like either, you know, either drinking, either drunk or horny was just, I don't know. It was so kind of narrow and didn't really build, like, none of the characters really got kind of expanded. We didn't really learn very much about them. I think the team talk that Pete Postlethwaite gives before Hallam's first game, that was, yeah, that gave me a little chill. More than a little chill. And I like Pete Postlethwaite, but the lines were just so generic, you know. These buggers think they've got League One. They've got the League One, but we'll show them. Right, boys. And a clap. Like, if anything, if you want to convince me this is authentic, this is a football film that, you know, at least represents what you know, amateur to Sunday League football is like, there is no manager that gives a speech that short and that vague. If anything, it's absolutely the opposite. They say way too much. They try to quote from films that they've seen. They try to be overly inspirational. They try to talk the big talk. And, you know, it's usually funny. There's actually entertainment. If they'd really wanted to look for it, they could have put real entertainment into that, into those little things, those little identifiers of football culture, and, you know, the overbearing, overeager, lots to say manager, to leave him with just such a kind of a generic thing was disappointing. It gave me a chill. I was like, yeah, they don't know what they're doing here.
Yeah, the manager at Sheffield gives a really short halftime speech as well. So there's really nothing. So
yeah, I think there's one more. There's one more thing where the Sheffield United manager, and I can't remember the actor's name, so I'm sorry, guys, you'll have to look it up. But he's been in lots in terms of English dramas and TV dramas. At one point, we get I think it's in the Man United game, we get the hint that Sean Bean's character Jimmy is about to enter the fray, and I can't remember, is it David is the player on the field, and he there's a piece of action and you hear a crowd noise going ooh, and the Sheffield United manager turns to his assistant and goes, ooh, David's not playing well.
After he gets like cracked on the leg.
I can't even remember what the point was, but I've just the very sentence, like, I don't think managers do that. You know, they'll talk in manager speak, or they won't say anything at all. It's so fucking obvious. Like, so when it's not happening for a player, you know, the people around you are football people. They'll know the idea that you have to turn around and go, oh, it's not going well for David today. Like, that gave me a chill. That actually made me laugh.
Yeah, they didn't. I think if there was gonna be any moment in this movie that set up like the good chills, you know, where like you know it's an inspiring sports movie, it would have been the PK at the end when he makes the basically it's a walk off. Makes the scores that last penalty kick and they win the game. But I don't think they built it up enough for me to where I didn't really get the chills when that came. I didn't get that, you know, that inspirational kind of thing that a lot of sports movies give you. So this one didn't have that.
No. And also there's nothing on the line. They needed to make it maybe like Jimmy Muir saves Sheffield United from relegation, or, you know, Jimmy Muir sends Sheffield United into the next round of the cup with a penalty and on his debut for the club, something like that. But also as well, just from a visual point of view, the penalty which they give the slow-mo treatment to, when he strikes it and the goalkeeper dives, it's actually much closer to the goalkeeper, and then it gives the behind-the-goal angle, and it's right in the top corner.
Yeah, to where he would have never been able to touch it. Yeah, they didn't put anything on the line between Jimmy. It didn't feel like it meant a lot to him. They didn't, like you said, they didn't set it up to where it meant a lot for Sheffield. He was fine with his girlfriend, so there was nothing like riding on that. It was just like, oh, good for him. But it didn't give me the chills. It didn't give me that, you know, this was the moment I'll take from this movie, which was kind of a bummer.
Yeah. And also, again, not to harp on about the, you know, the dead brother. I would have liked to see more in their relationship, rather than that one speech he gave him to believe in himself. You know, we see them. Jimmy's not playing well. He's giving the ball away. Mel Sterland, who was, if guys want to read up on Mel Sterland, he was quite the character himself. He had quite the life off the field himself, involving booze and other activities. But I'll leave that to your listeners to look up Mel Sterland. But, like, you know, we got Mel Sterland being unnecessarily aggressive. Then all of a sudden, he sees his dead brother take his seat at Bramall Lane, and then just like a light switch, he's playing brilliantly. So yeah, that gave me a chill too.
Mel Sterland's autobiography is called Boozing, Betting, and Brawling. So I think that's enough of an indication of just the life of Mel Sterling.
Yeah, it's There's something else about Mel Sterland, and I'm going to let people look it up. I don't want to say what it is because I may be mixing him up with another footballer, but he's had a very colorful life off the field, put it that way.
So he seems pretty underutilized in this movie. How would you improve it? Are there any quick fixes? Is there anything that something that you think would make a huge, change in the movie besides just bringing on, someone like yourself, bring on you to be the soccer consultant for the movie?
The road I would have gone down with, which is, again, this is why I'm not in Hollywood, and it's not the only reason, but it's why I don't think like people like that. There are thousands of footballers every year who are really good, who don't make the highest level in the game and have to leave the game, but are still brilliant footballers, and they end up in the amateur game or they give up altogether. Why not give the title role to one of those footballers and get a load of footballers who didn't make it, or amateur footballers who can play, and put them on the field and kind of, give it that kind of sense of realism. Also, just, we get it. We get it. Mid-90s Sheffield doesn't seem like a great place to live. But, reduce some of have it directed by someone who is from the north. So have it directed by someone who understands football culture and who doesn't look at it in this kind of New Labour manner.
Doesn't make it so depressing.
Yeah. It's important to, if you think about the, I told you, the Taylor Report had been released 6 years before, which changed English football. That was the investigation into the the debts at Hillsborough Stadium, and so stadiums were upgraded, and the landscape of English football changed then with the Sky TV sports deal, so more money came in. So that attracted a different class of people to watch the game, and obviously you can see their fingerprints all over this. I would have got, who would have made a better film? I'm trying to think of a, I think the director, and again, his name escapes me, but the director of This Is England, I think he would have done a better job of that. Just get someone who understands working class culture and understands football and let them at it. Let them do it and use ex-footballers. We don't need Sean Bean at 37.
Yeah, that's one of the things that, especially with this podcast, I'm a huge proponent of. I would rather watch athletes who've played the sport and who have been there. I would rather have good athletes who you teach how to act as opposed to actors who you're trying to teach how to play sports or be athletic, because one of those is very God-given and is just something that you know a good athlete when you see one. The other one, it can be learned. So, I think movies that go find athletes first. We did the podcast 2 weeks ago. We did the movie Miracle about the 1980 Miracle on Ice with the U.S. hockey team. For that entire team, they basically picked hockey players first. They picked guys who could skate and guys who talk like hockey players, who acted like hockey players. And it brings that kind of, I think guys who have been around the sport, people who have been around the sport, bring that feel with them in the movie. You can see that. You can see themselves, conduct themselves like players. There's a movie, a smaller baseball movie called Everybody Wants Some, about college baseball players, where they brought in a lot of guys who played baseball at, college or pro levels, and a lot of them were, not big-time actors. I hadn't been acting for a long time, and you still got good performances because they just felt like they were members of that sport. So that's something that I think every sports movie should keep in mind, is get someone who, I would say, get athletes first. I think it's a lot easier to teach an athlete to act than teach an actor to be a premier athlete, because one of them is very God-given.
I agree with you. I think also as well, I mean, we're lucky considering that moment in English cinema. That was when there was an explosion in British cinema. And I think it was a year later, 1997, Four Weddings and a Funeral came out. And I wouldn't put it past the kind of people that were making films at that time to think that Hugh Grant could have played the character of Sean Bean.
I was thinking you were going to say someone like Ewan McGregor.
Oh, McGregor could do it.
Oh, you think so?
McGregor could do it. Yeah. If you Trainspotting, McGregor,
Yeah, I could see McGregor doing that. He was young and lithe enough for me to believe that he was a professional footballer.
That's true. I could never watch. I don't think I could ever buy Hugh Grant. Being a professional soccer player.
No, I know. I'm being facetious there. I'm being facetious. Yeah. I'm sure they wouldn't even have done that. And I would not like to hear Hugh Grant's attempt at a Yorkshire accent.
not known for his acting prowess in that regard. JJ, thanks so much for coming on the podcast and really giving me like a full scale lesson in English football culture. This was really fun. I really enjoyed having you on.
Kyle, you're very welcome. This was just the ramblings of a man who is. I was obsessed with this movie for the longest time. I didn't get to see it because, for some reason, well, I lived in rural Ireland, so I had to go and actually rent the video when I was a kid. And for some reason, whenever I went to get it, it was never there. And so, when you suggested to me that we do a soccer film, I could easily have phoned this one in and done Goal or Goal 2 or even Green Street Hooligans. But I thought, why not go back to good old When Saturday Comes?
Well, I'm glad you picked it. This was a real treat for me to listen to. I think I've learned more than any of the other recordings. I appreciate you coming on. Where can the people follow you?
They can follow me on Twitter at JJ Devaney, but they can go and follow us on our official Twitter account for the podcast, Caught Offside, so at CO Soccer Pod on Twitter, and then Caught Offside ESPN on Instagram. And you can also just go to Spotify, the ESPN app, or iTunes and subscribe and listen to our podcast there, where often I interject when I get bored of talking about Premier League football and MLS. I will also talk about the championship, from whence Sheffield United have come.
Well, I encourage all the listeners to go check that out. You put on quite a show tonight, so I think it definitely gave everyone a reason to go listen to you. As for this podcast, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, and Google Play. Please make sure to subscribe, rate, leave a review, share with any friends that you have that might enjoy sports movies and authenticity in sports movies just as much as you. And you can catch us next week. Thanks.